Chapters of Life by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 2, Many Mansions. Alone he was, alone in the old rambling house in the heart of the moor. Far off, at the end of the long cultivated garden, a noisy brook went tumbling over the rocks and hissing across the stony stretches. On a warm day, he was wont to stand by that babbling brook, or perch on one of the large rocks overhanging the tumultuous torrent. Farther along, there was the little wooden bridge with the shaky handrail by which he crossed on his way to the small hamlet for his mail and shopping. It had been pleasant here, he and his wife. Together they had tried to make a home, tried to keep body and soul together while he painted and waited for recognition. But as usual, the press had not understood, nor tried to understand, his art, and so the critics had damned his work with faint praise. Recognition was as far off as ever, and now he was alone in the old, old house, his mind and mood in a turmoil matched by the gale outside. Across the moorland heather, the gale screeched in unbridled fury, lashing the yellow gorse, making it bow to the mighty wind. The distant sea was a boiling white mass of foam, with mighty waves breaking in thunder on the great granite shore, dragging back the pebbles with a nerve-jarring scream. A lone gull soared backwards overhead, blowing helplessly inland, powerless in the grip of the storm. The old house shook and shuddered to the ceaseless pounding of the elements. Flecks of cloud, driven low, whipped by the windows like ghosts seeking entry. A sudden metallic clatter and rumble, and a sheet of corrugated metal went spinning across the garden to strike the bridge and shear through the old timbers. For a time the broken ends vibrated like an overtaxed violin string. Then, one after another, they shuddered and tumbled into the brook. Inside the house, oblivious of the turmoil, the man paced back and forth, seeing again and again the moment when he had returned from the hamlet and found his wife gone. Rereading the bitter note in which she told him that he was a failure and she was going elsewhere. Grimly, as a sudden thought struck him, he strode to the battered old desk and wrenched open the center drawer. Rooting in the back, he dragged out the cigar box in which he kept the rent and living money. Even before he opened it, he knew that it was empty. The money, his only money, gone. Groping his way to a chair, he sat down and buried his head in his hands. "Before," he whispered, "before, this has happened to me before." Lifting his head, he stared unseeingly through the window against which torrential rain was beating in an unceasing stream, forcing its way through a loose-fitting window and collecting in a spreading pool on the carpet. "I've lived through all this before," he whispered. "Have I gone insane? How could I have known about this?" High up among the eaves, the wind shrieked in derision and gave the old house an extra shake and judder. Against the ancient stone hedge, the little moorland ponies huddled head to wind in abject misery, trying to get even slight shelter for stinging eyes. Away in the hall, the telephone rang and rang, jarring him from his lethargy. Slowly he made his way to the jangling instrument, which ceased its clanging even as he stretched out his hand to lift it. The same, he murmured at the uncaring walls. It has all happened before. The old professor plodded warily across the quadrangle on his way to the lecture hall. The years had been hard ones indeed. Born in very humble circumstances, he had been the bright boy who had slaved and earned that he could put himself through college. It had been almost a lifetime of clawing his way up against the opposition of those who resented his humble origin. Now, in the evening of his life, the weight of time was showing in his white hair, lined face, and feeble step. As he stumbled slowly along, oblivious of the greetings of undergraduates, he pondered on many obscure facets of his specialty, ancient history. Completely the model of the absent-minded professor, he fumbled for the doorknob of a door already open, and not finding it, turned away, muttering, "Dear, dear, most strange, most strange. There used to be a door here. I must be in the wrong building." An understanding student, one who had profited from the old man's brilliant lectures, took his arm and gently turned him around. "Here, sir," he said, "I have opened the door for you. In here." Gratefully, the professor turned and mumbled his thanks. Entering the lecture hall, he became a man transformed. Here was his life. Here he expounded upon ancient history. Moving like a man rejuvenated, he crossed to the rostrum and smiled benignly upon the assembled undergraduates. They smiled respectfully at him, for even though they did at times make fun of his forgetfulness, yet they still had a genuine liking for the lecturer who was so willing to help them to the full extent of his power. Remembering his own struggles, he took pleasure in helping the students in difficulties. Instead of flunking him, as was so often the case with other professors, glancing about him to see that his class was complete and all were ready, he said, "We are going to continue with our discussion about one of the great enigmas of history, the Sumerian civilization." Here was a mighty civilization which seems to have appeared in a most mysterious manner and disappeared in an equally mysterious manner. We have tantalizing fragments, but no clear picture. We know, for example, that 3,500 years B.C., the Sumerians were preparing beautifully written manuscripts. We have fragments of them, always fragments and no more. We know also that the Sumerians had a musical system which differed from any other system of musical notation throughout the Old or New Worlds. There has been discovered a clay tablet which, by scientific methods, indicates an age of some 3,000 years. The tablet has engraved upon it musical symbols which lead us to suppose that it was a hymn, but it has defied musical interpretation. The old man paused, his eyes open wide, as if seeing something beyond the normal vision of man. For a minute he stood thus, gazing into the infinite, then with a strangled groan he dropped to the floor. Stunned amazement held the class motionless for a moment, then two students rushed to his side, while another hurried out in search of medical assistance. A hushed assembly stood respectfully aside as two stretcher bearers carefully lifted the unconscious man, placed him upon the open stretcher, and bore him away to the waiting ambulance. The head, who had been called, appeared full of bustle and dismissed the class for the afternoon. Away in the cool hospital room, the old professor now regained consciousness, muttered to his doctor, "Strange, strange, I had the distinct impression that I had lived through this incident before, that I knew the origin of the Sumerians. I must have been working too hard, but I knew the answer, and now it has faded. Strange, strange." The middle-aged man squirmed uncomfortably upon the hard wooden bench, crossing first one leg and then the other. From time to time he lifted half-frightened eyes to gaze about him. From the end of the room came the harsh, impersonal voice of the nurse, grating out her monotonous orders. "Garland, you are to see Dr. Northey. Here are your cards. Take them in that door and wait until the doctor speaks to you. Rogers, you go to therapy. They want you to do some test. Here are your cards. Go down the corridor there." The voice continued like the voice of a bored announcer quoting the fat stock prices. The middle-aged man shuddered at the rows and rows of people before him. Patients unaccompanied, new patients with relatives with them, and some with burly attendants waiting nearby. The hours dragged on. Here and there, a man or woman screamed in the grip of some mental fantasy. Nearer, a man shouted, "I gotta, and when you gotta, you gotta." Jumping up, he rushed across the room, scattering people right and left, elbowing aside a clutching attendant, tripping a clerk before diving headlong through an open window. Throughout the ensuing commotion, the nurse's voice droned on imperturbably. Outside, the dull red brick buildings shimmered in the increasing heat. The glass of the many windows threw back the sun's reflection and showed the thousands of bars across the windows. Scores of blank-eyed men stood and shuffled as they grubbed along the gravel of the paths in search of weeds. Attendants loitered alertly in any available shade as they supervised the toiling men. Farther along, where the grassy slopes met the main drive, lines of dowdy women bent to the task of picking litter and stones from the grass before the mowers could do their work. Beneath a spreading tree, a gaunt woman stood in the pose of utter majesty as she scornfully surveyed the two watchful women attendants who were poised in anxious expectancy. At the main gates, two attendants stopped cars entire. At the main gates, two attendants stopped cars entering that the occupants might be directed. An inmate, appearing casual, tried to slip out behind an attendant's back, but was soon stopped. "Now, Alf," the attendant admonished, "back in you go, none of your tricks, I'm busy." Beyond the high stone walls and heavily barred gates, pedestrians peered in curiously, getting a thrill out of a forbidden peep at life inside the walls. In admittance, the middle-aged man stood up uncertainly as his name was eventually called. Rising to his feet, he walked to the nurse at the desk and said, "It's all a mistake. I..." "Yes, yes, I know. You're as sane as can be," interrupted the nurse. "They all say the same." Sighing, she picked up a card and some papers and signaled to a waiting attendant. "You'd better take this one to Dr. Hollis," she said when the attendant appeared. "He says it's all a mistake and he's sane. Mind he doesn't get away." "Come on, fella," said the attendant, grasping the middle-aged man by the arm and leading him through a small door. Together they trudged along a corridor lined with doors. From behind came some sighs, from others screams, and from yet another a queer bubbling sound, which made the attendant jump in alarm and energetically summon assistance to one whose life was bubbling away through a cut throat. The middle-aged man shivered and seemed to shrink. "Scared, eh?" asked the attendant. "You ain't seen nothing yet. You will." At last they stopped before a door. The attendant knocked and a distant voice called, "Come in." Pushing the middle-aged man before him, he entered and placed the card and papers on the desk. "Another one for you, doctor," said the attendant as he turned and withdrew. The doctor slowly reached out a languid hand and picked up the papers and compared them with the card. Then, without paying the slightest attention to the middle-aged man, he settled back in his swivel chair and began to read. Not until he had read every word and made notes did he look up and utter a terse, "Sit." "Now," said the doctor, as his patient sat shakily before him, "what's all this about? How do you think you can be in two places at once? Tell me about it." He sat back with an air of bored resignation and lit a cigarette. "Well, doctor," said the middle-aged man, "for some time I've had the strangest feeling that another part of me is living in some other part of the world. I feel as if I were one of identical twins sometimes, almost completely in rapport with the other." The doctor grunted and knocked the ash off his cigarette. "Any brothers or sisters?" he asked. "The report says none, but it could be wrong." "No, doctor, no brothers, no sisters, and no one with whom I am sufficiently friendly to account for this feeling. It's exactly as if I sometimes get in touch with another me somewhere else, someone who is also aware of this feeling." The doctor stubbed out his cigarette and said, "How frequently do you have these remarkable occurrences? Can you predict their onset?" "No, sir," the middle-aged man replied. "I may be doing something quite ordinary. Then I will experience a tingling in the navel, and after that I feel as if I were to telephone pole lines which have been crossed and both parties are receiving their own telephone calls as well as those of the other." Mused the doctor. "Does it inconvenience you in any way?" Yes, it does, doctor," the middle-aged man replied. "Sometimes I speak out loud and say the darndest things." The doctor sighed as he remarked, "So I see from this report. Well, we shall have to commit you to an observation ward until we can get the matter straightened out. You seem to be living in two worlds at the same time." At the doctor's signal, the attendant entered the room. "Take him to observation B3, please. I'll see him later in the day." The attendant motioned to the middle-aged man, and together they turned and went out of the doctor's office. The doctor sat motionless for a moment, then pushed his glasses up to his forehead and energetically scratched the back of his neck. Lighting a fresh cigarette, he leaned back in his swivel chair and put his feet on the desk. "It seems we have a lot of people in nowadays," he said to himself, "who believe they're living twin existences. I suppose next we shall have people saying they are living in parallel worlds or something." The brr-brr of his telephone jerked him back to the present, and slipping his feet off the desk, he reached out for the phone and got ready for the next patient. There are such things as parallel worlds, because everything must have its counterpart in a reverse state, just the same as you cannot have a battery which is only positive or only negative. There must be positive and negative, but that is a matter to be discussed in our next chapter. Now we have parallel worlds. Unfortunately, scientists who have been afraid of losing face or something, or sinking into matters beyond their depth, have confused the issue because they will not face up to the thought of having genuine research. Yet in India, the adepts of years gone by referred to their linga sharira, which means the part of the body which is in a different dimension, beyond the three dimensions of this world, and so cannot be perceived normally by a person existing in this three-dimensional world. We have to remember that upon this world we are confined to three dimensions, for this is wholly a three-dimensional world, and to the average person who has not studied anything about metaphysics, the fourth dimension is something to laugh about or read about in some remarkable science fiction. Not merely is there a fourth dimension, but beyond the world of the fourth there are the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, eighth, and ninth. In the ninth, for example, one attains realization and is able to comprehend the nature of things. One is able to comprehend the origin of life, the origin of the soul, how things started, and what part mankind plays in the evolution of the cosmos. In the ninth dimension, also, man, still a puppet of the over-self, is able to converse face to face with his over-self. One of the greatest difficulties is the unfortunate fact that scientists have set up all sorts of extraordinary and arbitrary rules, and if one dares to contradict anything that these scientists say, then one is really ostracized. An example of that may be found in the way in which the medical profession was completely crippled for hundreds of years because of the works of Aristotle. It was considered to be a great crime to do any investigation into the human body because Aristotle had taught all there was to know, ever. So until the medical profession could escape from the dead hand of Aristotle, they could do no dissections and no post-mortems, and they could do no research. Certain astronomers had much the same difficulty when they taught that Earth was not the center of creation, because some early wonderful man had taught that the sun revolved around the Earth, and that everything existed for the comfort of mankind. But now we have to get on with our dimensions. Here on this earth, we deal with that which is commonly known as three dimensions. We see a thing and we feel a thing, and it appears solid and real to us. But suppose we had to deal with an extra dimension. The first thing would be, well, what is this extra dimension? Possibly we could not quite comprehend it. What could be a fourth dimension? Worse, what would be a fifth? And then go on up to the ninth, or even beyond the ninth. The best thing is to consider first an ordinary tape recorder, because most people have access to a tape recorder or have seen one. We have a tape recorder running at a very slow speed, less than an inch a second. At such a slow speed, one could have a tape message last for an hour. But supposing we made that tape play back at, for example, a foot a second, then the speech would be quite unintelligible to us. The message upon the tape would have not altered in any way. The words would be the same, but in effect we would have moved our speech to another dimension, and so we could not comprehend the speech. Before we could comprehend that which was upon the tape, we should have to play the tape at the same speed as that employed in recording it. Incidentally, marine biologists have used tape recordings and have discovered that fish of all kinds talk. There is, in fact, a special phonographic record giving sounds of the sea in which there are sounds of the fish talking to each other, and even lobsters and crabs communicating. If you find this hard to believe, remember that dolphins have had their speech recorded on tape. Dolphins speak many, many times faster than humans. So the speech was recorded on tape and was quite unintelligible to humans, but the tape was slowed to a dimension, or speed, acceptable to human ears. Now the scientists are trying to decipher the tapes, and at the time of writing this, it has been stated that these scientists are able to compile a vocabulary so that eventually they may be able to communicate in extenso with dolphins. But back to our parallel worlds. Many, many years ago, when I had escaped from the Russians and was making my slow and painful way across Europe to eventually reach a free country, I chanced to stop in war-torn Berlin, then being desecrated by the savage Russians. I was walking about, wondering what to do next, wondering how to pass the time until nightfall, when I should hope to be able to get a lift upon my way towards the French border. I walked along, looking at the still smoldering ruins, where Allied bombs had reduced most of Berlin to shattered rubble. In a little cleared spot, beneath twisted steel girders, now turning red with rust, I saw a ramshackle stage set up surrounded by those bomb-racked buildings. There was scenery of a sort upon the stage, scenery made from bits of salvaged material from the wreckage. They had some poles, and from the poles were stretched pieces of sacking so as to obscure as much as possible a view of the stage from those who had not paid to enter. I was interested, and looking farther I saw there were two old men. One was standing before a curtain taking money. He was tattered and unkempt, but there was a certain air of something, majesty, I suppose, about him. I forget now how much money I paid to enter. Not much, because none of us had much money in war-torn Berlin. But as I paid, he put the money in his pocket and courteously motioned me through the tattered and bedraggled curtain. As I went beyond the curtain, I saw some planks bridging rubble, and on those planks people were sitting. I took my seat too. Then a hand came through the curtain and waved. An old, thin man, bent with the weight of years, shuffled to the center of the stage and made a little address in German, telling us what we were going to see. Then turning away, he went behind a backdrop. For a moment we saw him with two sticks in his hands, and from those two sticks depended a number of puppets, inanimate lumps of wood, roughly carved to represent a human shape, dressed up in gaudy rags, with painted features and lumps of hair stuck on top. They were crude. They really were crude. And I thought that I had wasted money which I could ill afford. But I was tired of walking, tired of just ambling about, attempting to evade Russian and German police patrols. So I kept to my hard seat and thought that I had wasted the money, I would waste some time as well. The old man shuffled out of sight at the back of his little ramshackle stage. Somehow, he had rigged up lighting of some kind. These were now dimmed, and on this very makeshift stage appeared figures. I stared hard and rubbed my eye, for they weren't puppets. These were living creatures. Gone completely was the crudity of hacked wood, daubed over with color, topped with horsehair, and swaddled with bits of rag salvaged from bombed ruins. Here were living people. People, each with a mind of its own. People intent on the task at hand. People who moved of their own volition. There was no music, of course, and no sound. No sound, that is, except for the asthmatically wheezing of the old man, now hidden in the back. But sound was not necessary. Sound of any kind would have been superfluous. The puppets were life. Every movement, every gesture was expressive. Speech was unnecessary, for these motions were in the universal language of picture. Pantomime. There seemed to be an aura around these puppets who had now become people. They seemed to take on the identity and personality itself of that which they were, at the moment, representing. No matter how much I peered, I could not see the strings going from the heads. These were indeed artfully hidden against the background. Before me, the scenes of life were being enacted with absolute fidelity to the human counterparts. I lost myself in following the actions and the motives. We watched human drama, and our pulses raced in sympathy with the underdog. This was excitement. This was real. But at last the show came to an end, and I roused myself as if from a trance. I knew that a real genius was controlling those puppets. A master of masters. And then the old man came out from behind his stage and bowed. He was shaking with fatigue. His face was white with the strain and covered with a thin sheen of perspiration. He was indeed an artist. He was indeed a master. And we saw not a tattered, battered old man clad in rags, but the genius who manipulated those crude puppets and brought them to life. As I turned away, I thought of the things I had learned in Tibet. I thought of my beloved guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, and how he had shown me that man is just a puppet of his over-self. I thought also how this puppet show had been a wonderful lesson on parallel worlds. Man is 9/10 subconscious and 1/10 conscious. You've probably read quite a lot about it, because the whole science of psychology is devoted to the various facets and idiosyncrasies of man's subconscious. Remembering that man is so little conscious, does it not occur to you what a shocking waste of time it is for a powerful, powerful over-self, gifted with all manners of abilities and talents, pulsing with the power of a more vibrant world and of a different way of life, who comes to this world laden with troubles and obstacles and then to function at most, 1/10 of its ability? Suppose you had a motor car, let us say an 8-cylinder car, because there do not seem to be any 10-cylinder cars, to make the illusion more exact. Let us say we have an 8-cylinder car, then, just for the purpose of this illustration. We have this 8-cylinder car, but we find that it is working on 1 cylinder alone. 7 cylinders are not in any way contributing towards the function of the car. They are, in fact, holding it back even more because of the inertia. The performance is deplorable, but think of it in terms of human existence. Mankind is like a 10-cylinder car, only 1 cylinder of which is working. The other 9 are subconscious. Wasteful, isn't it? The over-self of a human, or any other creature either for that matter, does not waste energy. The over-self of a human has a number of tasks which must be accomplished. Supposing we had an evolved over-self who is anxious to progress to other planes of existence, one who is anxious to go up and up and up to different dimensions. In that case, the over-self might devote 1/10 of its ability to dealing with the body on Earth, and the rest of its abilities might go to dealing with bodies on other planets or other planes of existence. Or it might even be without puppet bodies on other planes of existence and be moving in what one might term pure spirit instead. But if the over-self is not that far evolved or has a different scheme of operations, it might do things in a different way. Supposing our over-self is more or less a beginner, then you can say that it is the same as a student in secondary school. The student has to attend a number of classes instead of having to learn just one subject. Often this means that the student had to walk to different classes or to different centers, and that really does waste a lot of time and energy. The over-self is in a far more satisfactory position. It is the puppet master. Upon this world, which we call Earth, there is a puppet which is the Earth body, and which functions with 1/10 of the over-self's attention. Upon a parallel world, in another dimension, the over-self could have another puppet, or perhaps 2 or 3, or more puppets, and it would then be able to manipulate these between various tasks. To go back to our student, one might say that this is like a student who can remain aloof in his private room and send his deputies to the different classrooms so that he can gain all the experience required through these different sources and connect them up later. Let us assume that the over-self is having to rush things somewhat in order to catch up with the cycle of evolution. Supposing the over-self has been a bit slow or a bit lazy, and he's had various setbacks, and this over-self does not want to be left in the same class or state after the others have passed on. So, he has to take, in effect, a cramming course, the same as a child or older student takes extra lessons in order that he may keep up with others who are more advanced and so remain in close touch with them. The overself may have a person living one life in Australia and may have yet another person doing something else in Africa. Perhaps there will be another one in South America or Canada or England. There may be more than three, there may be five or six or seven. These people might never meet on Earth, and they would still be very much in affinity with each other. They may have telepathic rapport without in any way understanding why, but then occasionally they would meet in the astral, just as traveling salesmen meet sometimes in the sales manager's office. The poor, wretched overself with seven or eight or nine puppets would really have to get a move on to manipulate them all at once and avoid crossing the wires. This is one explanation of some curious dreams, because frequently when two compatible puppets are asleep, their silver cords might touch and would produce an effect similar to those cross telephone lines, wherein you hear pieces of others' conversations. But sadly, and to one's immense regret, we miss all the most interesting bits. But what is the purpose of all this, you might ask? Well, that's easy to answer. By having a number of puppets, the overself can have vast experience and can live 10 lives in just one lifetime. The overself can experience riches and poverty at the same time, and so weigh them in the balance of experience. One puppet in one country could be a beggar, making a miserable living, hardly existing, in fact, while in some other country the next puppet could be a prince, gaining experience of how to handle men and how to shape a nation's policy. The beggar would be gaining experience of misery and suffering, so that when his lifetime of experience was blended to that of the prince puppet, the overself would know of the seamier side of life and would know that there are at least two sides to every question. In the normal course of events, people would perhaps come as a prince and then wait for another life to come as a beggar, or the other way around. But when they are rushed for time, when any given cycle of evolution is near its end, as is the present case, then heroic methods have to be adopted in order that those who are slower may yet keep up with the rest. We are now entering the Aquarian Age, an age wherein much will happen to man, and man's spirituality will increase. It is about time that it did, by the way. Man's psychic ability also will increase. Many people now living on the earth will not be reborn to the earth, but will go on to different stages of evolution. Many of those who have not learned in this life or in this cycle of existence will be sent back like naughty schoolboys to start in the next cycle. If a boy is left behind by his class at school, he is often dissatisfied and disgruntled that he is left behind, and he tends to play his part and show that he knows more, is better, bigger, and all that sort of thing. And the newcomers to the class almost always dislike the boy who is left over from the previous class. It is the same in the classroom of life. A person who has been rejected as not sufficiently evolved to go on to the next stage of existence has to come back and do that cycle all over again. His subconscious memory, contained in the 9/10 of the subconscious, resents it and he tends to get ahead in one particular way. Many people, after leaving this earth, will go on to a different form of existence, ever higher, for man always must climb up higher and higher, as indeed must all creatures, and the spirit of man, being gregarious by nature, delights to be in company with loved ones. Thus it is that an over-self will make really determined efforts and will use many puppets in order that it may keep up with its fellows. Let us accept, then, that a parallel world is a world in a different dimension, a world which is much like Earth, but yet is in a different dimension. If you find that difficult to comprehend, supposing you could go to the other side of the world instantly, in the twinkling of an eye, now decide for yourself, are you living in the past? That is, have you gone back to yesterday? Or have you traveled to the future? According to your calendar, you will find that when you cross various date lines, you travel either backwards or forwards as much as a complete day. So, it is theoretically possible to move a day into the future, according to your basic time, or to a day in the past. Having agreed that that is so, you should be able to agree that there are various dimensions which cannot be easily explained, which nevertheless do exist, as do parallel worlds. It is always amazing that people can readily believe that the heart can pump 10 tons of blood in an hour, or that there are 60,000 miles of capillary tubing in the body, and yet a simple thing like parallel worlds causes them to raise their eyebrows in disbelief and thereby make an astonishing amount of muscles go to work. Our subconscious is usually quite difficult to reach, difficult to plumb. If we could easily reach our subconscious, we could, at all times, find out what other puppets of ours were doing in other worlds, or in other parts of this world. And that would lead to very considerable confusion, alarm, and despondency. For example, think. Today you have done certain things, but if you could get into your subconscious and find yourself living the life of another puppet of yours who had done the same thing last week, or who intended to do it next week, it would lead to quite amazing confusion. This is one of the many reasons why it's so very difficult to tap into the subconscious. At times, things happen whereby there is an involuntary breakthrough between the conscious and the subconscious. It is a serious matter indeed, so serious that it is usually dealt with in a mental home. It leads to all sorts of psychotic conditions because the poor, wretched sufferer is unable to determine which is the body in which he is supposed to reside. Have you ever heard of the book The Three Faces of Eve? A woman was possessed by three different entities. The whole thing has been written about by quite a number of reputable doctors and specialists who presumably know what they are writing about. Have you ever read the story of Bridie Murphy? That is a similar case. Again, a person was possessed by another entity, or in other words, there was a breakthrough in the subconscious from one puppet to another. And then we have the matter of Joan of Arc. Joan believed that she was a great leader, that she had messages from higher sources. Joan of Arc, a very simple, uneducated country girl, turned into a warrior and a leader of warriors because the silver cords between two puppets became tangled and Joan received impulses designed for a man in a different body. For a time she acted as that man, as that leader of men, as that great warrior, and then, when the lines were untangled, her powers failed, and she was once again the simple country girl who had to pay a penalty for temporary and mistaken fame. She was burned to death. In the case of the victim of the Three Faces of Eve, a multiple breakthrough or breakdown occurred, and the poor woman was placed in unwilling contact with other puppets controlled by the same over-self. These other puppets were in a similar condition. They also suffered this breakthrough, and as a result, there was complete chaos. It is the same when you get two or three puppets and you are careless or inexperienced or let your attention wander. The cords become entangled. You pull a string which should control puppet A, but because of the tangle, you might cause puppet B to kick and puppet C to nod its head. In the same way, when you get a breakthrough between the conscious and subconscious, an uncontrolled breakthrough, that is, then you get interference from and with others who are being controlled by the same over-self. Bridie Murphy? Yes, that's also true. That was a breakthrough into the subconscious, and again a tangling of cords and a transference of impressions. Joan of Arc, as we have seen, was a simple country girl without education of any kind. She spent long periods alone in contemplation, and in one such period she quite accidentally broke through to the subconscious. Probably she did a special breathing exercise without even knowing it, because all this can be done deliberately and under full control. Anyway, she broke through to the subconscious, crossed strings with another puppet, and really got into a mess. She had all the impulses of a warrior, and she became a warrior. She wore armor and rode a horse. But what happened to the poor fellow who was intended to become a leader? Did he develop womanly traits? Well, if we speculate on that, we can lead ourselves to all sorts of unfortunate conclusions. But Joan of Arc became a leader of men, a warrior hearing voices from the sky. Of course she did. She was picking up impressions from the silver cord, which, after all, is only our puppet string. Think of that. Our puppet string. We have a silver cord that is also mentioned in the Bible, where, as you may remember, in the 12th chapter of Ecclesiastes, it is said, "Or ever the silver cord be loosed, or the golden bowl be broken, or the pitcher be broken at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern." People write about time and relativity, parallel worlds, and all of that. They use such big words that even they do not understand what they mean, but possibly you have got the general idea from this chapter. Remember, all this is true. All this is absolute fact, and one day, in the not-too-distant future, science will break down a few barriers and a few prejudices and will realize the truth of parallel worlds. End of chapter 2.